has claimed that it has tried to cultivate an image of a statesman who advocates racial equality, the deep-rooted problems of racial injustice and racial inequality in the United States have descended from an illness of limbs into organic degeneration. As Kevin Rudd correctly pointed out, the unsustainable economic inequities across American society have fueled a wave of popular extremism. The United States of America is a nation in gradual decay, and in spite of its illusionary goodwill in promoting human rights diplomacy, the United States has a notorious record in entrenching racial injustice in its criminal justice system.
National identity.
We all have experienced several World Cups. It isn't important since when. It isn't important how many editions. You know what an amazing phenomenon the World Cup is. It is the biggest event on the planet. It's a large mirror that reflects human beings today. That's why we follow the World Cup. It's beyond a sports competition. This is a place where we accurately realize many things. For example, have you ever thought about the fact that the World Cup is a political map of the world on a smaller scale? Have you ever thought that the World Cup is the venue of confrontation between nations? Have you ever thought that the World Cup can somehow be a battlefield? This is what we're going to talk about today. Thirty-two countries, 32 kits, and 32 flags. The World Cup is the venue where the 32 countries meet.
Some can-can on the Champs-Élysées tonight.
During the days the competitions are being held, no one remembers which player plays in which club or how much he earns. The only thing that matters is the name of his country. Well, this is a reality. Some players are larger or at least more famous than their clubs, but no player can outgrow his country. When we talk about national competitions, all players, even the most outstanding ones, are overshadowed by their national outfits and flags. They wear the shirts whose color definitely resembles their national flags. They line up at stadiums and proudly sing their national anthems out loud or even cry while they're singing. When they win, they kiss their shirts or their national flags, and when they lose, they try to show their respect to their national symbols one way or another. During those days, the interviews by the players or what they post on social media are full of nationalistic phrases. We don't get the feeling that they're just watching an ordinary football match. It is quite serious. You can see the traces of nationalism and patriotism everywhere. The fights, the goals, efforts, failures, or even the incidents on the benches. Everything is like a serious fight. But this isn't the entire story. You can find radio patriotism in other places too. On the stands, where people are immersed in their national symbols and are seriously and anxiously following the developments. In the media, all across the world and on the streets everywhere in the world. This is the simple definition. The World Cup is a battlefield for 32 nations. This is a place where they can fight with other nations in front of all nations and show their merits. Without even firing a bullet or shedding a drop of blood. Everything FIFA has done to bridge the gap between nations and all efforts it makes to promote the understanding between nations and consolidate unity in the World Cup has so far failed to change this reality. The national identity of the participating countries is one of the most important factors that makes this event attractive. This is the most important incentive for the players, the most important incentive for the people around the world to watch the matches, and the most important need of those who are involved in the economic aspects to make money. That's why we have to take a closer look at the direct relationship between the World Cup and national identities. How does the World Cup affect the identity of different nations? On the other hand, we need to ask how much of the World Cup is made by national identity. This is the most obvious point. The World Cup is a factor for national. When the World Cup is being held, the participating countries are in a completely different mood. Everything is affected by the national matches. The streets look different. Politicians, artists, and ordinary people have no obsession besides the World Cup. Everyone is in the same color. Everyone holds the same flag. They cry for the same thing. They get happy for the same thing. And it means filling the gaps. Political, social, ethnic, and religious differences fade away. The poorest people on the outskirts of Sao Paulo and the richest people in Rio de Janeiro get excited for the same reasons. The Basque and Catalan separatists, as well as people in Madrid, watch the same match. Even in some cases, like the Ivory Coast in 2006, the war and internal strife end up in peace, and it only means one thing. Football is uniting them. Everyone feels that they belong to the same group. Everyone feels that by supporting the players on the field, They showed their loyalty to a large group of people like themselves. And this isn't small. This isn't small at all. The other factor is national pride. The World Cup is a venue to revive the national pride of countries that were previously ignored. The elation by the Senegalese when they defeated colonizer France, and the crazy excitement by the Romanians when their team defeated the great Argentina. To be honest, the feelings of these countries towards their nationalities are totally different before and after the event. They restore their trampled pride. Sometimes restoring the pride is much larger than what you can describe. In the 1990 World Cup, when the nine-man Cameroon defeated Argentina to reach the quarterfinals and take Britain to the verge of defeat, Roger Milla's joy was what everyone in the Black Continent felt. In 1998, when Croatia shattered mighty Germany with three goals, Davor Šuker's screams were the screams of the people who had recently gained independence after a bloody civil war. In the 1990 World Cup, when Rijkaard spit in Voller's hair, for the people of the Netherlands, it was a symbol of hatred towards the German occupiers. It's true, the World Cup unites people in a country and gives them the feeling of pride. There's a significant reason behind that. Players play with their country's national kits and under their flags and are considered a sample of their own society. The happy and boundless culture of Brazilians can be spotted in their artistic play. The hard work and discipline of the Japanese stands out in their courageous style of playing. Germans play football like machines, just like their culture.
A quick German thrust puts Watts clean through.
Actually, teams are considered their nation's representatives in the World Cup in every aspect. World Cup is a World Cup because the coaches, reporters, spectators, and everyone else knows that it isn't just about football matches. This is the place where people's national identities, and even more than that, emerge. People in underprivileged countries always get happy when weak countries win. People always get happy when their traditional rival loses. Even those who migrated from their homeland many years ago and don't even speak their mother tongue any longer find their lost nationalistic feeling during the World Cup matches. If we take a look at history, this characteristic has always been inherent in the World Cup. The first World Cup was held under heavy nationalistic feelings. Uruguay was the host and wanted to achieve pride for the less-known country by hosting the event. They did everything they could to gain the pride. They sold their agricultural products at the lowest price. They increased the tax on people's basic commodities. They sold bonds. That was how they managed to construct the largest stadium in the world. They held the first World Cup in history and became the champion. The final match was held between Argentina and Uruguay, two neighboring countries with deep-rooted hostilities. And after the final match, people in Buenos Aires pelted rocks at the Uruguay diplomatic mission. Later on, the World Cup champion in 1934 and 1938 took advantage of the patriotism to become the champion. Vittorio Pozzo, when Mussolini's rule had summarized the life of Italian in patriotism, would take his players to the ruins of the First World War and would force them to sing military songs. Two consecutive championships in the World Cup boosted the nationalistic and fascist feelings in Italy. In the final match of the World Cup in 1950, when 183,000 people gathered in the Maracana Stadium, the mayor of Rio de Janeiro delivered a speech. He said he was sure that his country was already the winners. Uruguay's amazing win in the most dramatic final in history turned the stadium into a huge cemetery. Brazil remained mired in grief for weeks, while people in Montevideo were walking on the streets and whispering their national anthem. The story continued. When Germany played Hungary in the final match in 1954, the Germans' boundless zeal changed the result.
Into the center, and a shot, now a shot, yes, a goal! A goal scored by Möller.
Their resistance in the face of striking attacks by Hungary and the splendid comeback. They wanted to revive their pride lost in the World War, and they succeeded. In the 1950s, the French got Moroccan Jos Fontaine on their team.
This time it's Dewey who gets his name on the score sheet.
In the 60s, the Portuguese used Mozambican Isubio. And in the following years, the Netherlands used Surinamese stars. The players would reach the national team from the colonized countries and save the national team. It was a sample of what the colonizing power did. It was a country that could bring far-flung countries under its flag.
Always danger, lays it outside and finds Valdana. He can't turn. Maradona's there, rises above ship. And is that goal going to be allowed?
Maradona displayed the biggest national show in the history of the World Cup. He scored the most spectacular goal in history. He scored, in fact, the most controversial goal in history and humiliated aggressor Britain all by himself. Maradona took revenge for the Belgrano ship that was sunk after sailing for 12,000 kilometers to occupy his country. By just a scurry look at history, you'll see several other vivid examples. Iranian players sacrificed themselves in front of the U.S. North Korean players showed a lot of bravery against powerful Brazilians. who can claim that the old scores between countries are not effective in clashes amid World Cup matches. Like this strange foul by Tony Schumacher or the famous headbutt by Zidane. Or even the fight between Simeone and Beckham. It's true, the history of the World Cup is affected by the zeal for nationality more than anything else. Let's not forget that the World Cup isn't just about football matches. The World Cup is the biggest international event on our planet where nations fight against each other with all their national symbols and try to defend their credit. It's a good opportunity for different groups in a country to converge. It's a good opportunity to bolster national pride in nations that have been humiliated. It's a good opportunity to achieve victory, revenge, and to be seen. Everyone knows that. People who wave their national flags on the streets, the players who wholeheartedly throw themselves in front of the ball, politicians and the media, let's not forget that the World Cup is an opportunity to analyze nations as they really are and to see the national identity of people more deeply. It's a time to discover the state of the world. This time, we could watch it a little deeper. This is called football. Watch it carefully.
From east to west, throughout the vast land of Iran, you're listening to IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
4 out of 10 Americans believe that their economic situation has worsened since President Joe Biden took office, and this number is the highest in the last 37 years. We take a look at some of the world media's and press's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The MarketWatch website has covered this story and tells us more. A new opinion poll showed a record number of Americans say they are worse off financially since President Joe Biden took office, the most ever recorded by the poll in its 37 years of asking the question. According to the ABC News Washington Post poll, 41% of the American public say they are in a tougher financial situation since President Joe Biden's inauguration in January of 2021, while just 16% say they are better off. Those numbers stand in stark contrast to when the poll asked Americans the same question 2 years after the election of former President Donald Trump, when just 13% said they were worse off and 25% said they were better off. The opinion poll also showed Biden with a 42% approval rating and a 53% disapproval rating. When asked about the upcoming 2024 presidential election, 62% of the American public said they would be disappointed or angry if Biden were to be re-elected as president, while just 36% said they would be enthusiastic or satisfied. Just 31% of Democrats and Democrat-leaning independents said Biden should be the party's presidential nominee, while 58% said the Democratic Party should pick someone else. Joe Biden has not yet said he will run for re-election, but has hinted his announcement could be imminent. He told a crowd of Democratic officials and activists recently, "We're just getting started, and I intend to get more done." Donald Trump is so far the only announced candidate on the Republican side, but former United Nations Ambassador Nikki Haley is expected to announce her candidacy at an event in South Carolina on 15th of February. 62% of the American public say President Biden has not achieved much during his first 2 years in office, despite efforts by Democratic leaders to frame that time as the most productive in Washington since Lyndon B. Johnson's Great Society agenda. Only 36% of Americans surveyed said they thought Biden had accomplished a great deal or a good amount. The survey revealed big disparities in how Americans viewed Joe Biden among Democrats, independents, and Republicans. 93% of Republicans said Biden has accomplished not much or little or nothing. That view was shared by 66% of independents and only 22% of Democrats. The opinion poll shows the challenge Biden and Democrats face in Congress in selling their accomplishments to voters before the 2024 presidential election. Reuters news agency has also covered this story and tells us more. A new opinion poll shows that U.S. President Joe Biden's approval rating has plunged close to the lowest level of his presidency. The Reuters Ipsos poll said Biden's public approval rating stood at 41% on Tuesday, 7th of February, as he prepared for an announcement that is expected to serve as a blueprint for a 2024 re-election bid. The national survey also showed that 65% of the American public think the country is on the wrong track, up from 58% a year earlier. According to the new opinion poll, many Americans are uncomfortable with Washington's large debts, as some 55% said they oppose raising the debt ceiling, including 32% of Democrats and 78% of Republicans. The 80-year-old Joe Biden faced new criticism over a probe into classified documents found in his home in recent months after he had condemned his predecessor, Donald Trump, for mishandling classified documents when he left the White House in 2021. The survey found that 65% of the American public think the issue of debt payment and federal spending should be handled separately, while only 26% said Congress should raise the debt ceiling only if Congress agrees to cut spending. 83% of Democrats and 74% of independents said debt payments and federal spending should be handled separately, while only 41% of Republicans said the two issues shouldn't be linked. People gave Joe Biden and Democrats little credit for two of their biggest accomplishments in the last Congress, the Bipartisan Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act and the Inflation Reduction Act, which included prescription drug reform. 32% of the American public said Joe Biden has made progress improving roads and bridges in their community, and 30% said Biden made progress lowering prescription drug costs. 60% of respondents said President Biden hasn't made much progress improving roads and bridges, and 47% said he hasn't made much of a dent in prescription drug prices. The Fox News Channel has also covered this story. Americans had similarly glum views of Biden's record creating more jobs and making electric vehicles more affordable. Only 34% of respondents said President Biden has made progress creating good jobs, and 26% said he has made progress making electric vehicles more affordable. Recently, U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen has warned that the United States could see a recession and cause a global financial crisis if it defaults on its national debt as lawmakers grapple over raising the debt limit. Janet Yellen made the comments recently in Senegal, West Africa, where she's on a three-country visit. Her remarks came after the U.S. Treasury started taking extraordinary measures to fend off a default as the country reached its $31.4 trillion debt ceiling. The U.S. Treasury has warned that the extraordinary measures would only help for a limited period of time. The polling results are disappointing for President Joe Biden, who recently claimed the creation of 12 million jobs since he took office in January of 2021, including 517,000 new jobs created last month. Americans surveyed by the Washington Post ABC News poll expressed little confidence that Joe Biden, lawmakers in Congress, or Speaker of the Congress Kevin McCarthy would make the right decisions for the country's future. Only 31% of Americans said they have a great deal or good amount of confidence that Biden would make wise decisions. Meanwhile, 25% of the survey's respondents said they had a great deal or a good amount of confidence in Democrats in Congress, while 28% said they felt confident about Republicans in Congress making wise decisions, and only 19% said they felt confident that Kevin McCarthy, the Speaker of the House, would make the right decisions for the country.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
This year, Iran is marking the 44th anniversary of the victory of the glorious Islamic Revolution. This revolution inspired many across the world, especially the people of Africa, who have for centuries suffered from exploitation by Western imperialist powers. A Nigerian intellectual, Sadiq Abba, elaborates.
Subsequent developments and scenarios that emerge in Iran prove that, yes, the Iranian revolution is not only a model, but it's a calling to mankind, especially societies and nations that are landlocked by imperialism and exploitative tendencies of neocolonialism.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of news and events making headlines in Africa. The 44th anniversary of the victory of the 1979 Islamic Revolution is being marked this year amid moves by several African countries to follow Iran's footsteps in resisting imperialist powers. In the recent past, Ghana has moved to dump the US dollar in some of its transactions, while Zimbabwe has banned the export of raw materials in a bid to stop the plunder of the country's natural resources by Western multinationals. In our show today, we are focusing on how the Islamic Revolution continues to inspire African countries and the rapidly improving trade ties between Iran and Africa. Stay with us as our experts give us their insight on today's subject.
Iran's Islamic Revolution, an inspiration for Africa. Iran's Islamic Revolution inspired and continues to inspire the people of Africa in their resistance against exploitative imperialists that seek to loot the continent's natural resources. The Islamic Revolution particularly inspired indigenous South Africans in their struggle to topple the apartheid regime. Nelson Mandela, the South African liberation struggle hero, visited the Islamic Republic of Iran in 1992, 2 years before he was elected president. Upon his arrival in Tehran, Mandela said, "We are here to thank the Iranian government and nation for their support in the black people's struggle against apartheid."
During his meeting with the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, Mandela addressed him as "my leader." Well, for more on how the Islamic Revolution continues to inspire African nations, we are joined by Dr. Abubakar Salati Bello, the Vice President of the African Students' Union in the Iranian holy city of Qom, and Mr. Zakir Ahmad, a South African-based lawyer, activist, and political analyst. Thank you, gentlemen, for joining us today. So let's start off with Dr. Salati Bello. How is the Islamic Revolution viewed by the people of Africa in general?
There is a lot of injustice being perpetrated by the imperialists in the Africa continent. Because of this, most of the Africans, they are seeing Iran as a model, as something that one can be looking upon. Even, for example, like for Nigeria, the history of Islamic Revolution is being studied in the higher education in some universities. For example, colleges of education in Nigeria, in the curriculum, there is an history about Islamic Revolution of Iran. Yeah, that's why the fact that Nigeria is not Iran. But because of the importance of this Islamic Revolution, is being studied in various universities. There are some secondary schools that they are studying this event of this Islamic Revolution. In the perspective of Africa, the Islamic Revolution is very, very important, and they are looking up to that Islamic Revolution, because we are hoping that this Islamic Revolution will not only stay in Iran, but it will get across. That is, the thought of Islamic Revolution will cut across all the whole continent of Africa and some other countries in the world.
Okay, let's bring in Mr. Zakir. Now, what's the opinion of the masses in Africa regarding the Islamic Revolution of Iran?
There's generally a very positive approach towards the Islamic Revolution. We must bear in mind that one of the test cases within the African continent was South Africa and the Islamic Republic of Iran's approach post-revolution to the apartheid regime. They were one of the first countries to divest from the Sasol project, Sasol being the backbone of petroleum within South Africa, and at the time of Shah. 90% of the petroleum came from the Islamic Republic, but before that, Iran. So therefore, when we look at the approach of the Islamic Republic of Iran towards Africa, and particularly South Africa, it has been one that has asserted the rights of the African people against colonialism and imperialism.
Now, how has the Islamic Revolution contributed to the awakening of the people of Africa in the battle against imperialism and neocolonialism?
Islamic Revolution in Iran, so it has given the people of Africa the capacity, the guts, to be able to face this imperialism. Because up to this moment, we are seeing it, we are looking it outwardly. You'll be saying that maybe the imperialists, they have left. We have had our independence. But in recent, we don't have independence. Inanely, yeah, silently, they are still there controlling everything. The Islamic Revolution, they can see how the Islamic Revolution started. Without anything, it started like that, and you can see the rate of development, the rate of advancement of Iran as a result of chasing away the imperialism. We see development in Iran in education, in technology, in engineering, in a lot of it, because the people are doing things by themselves.
Many analysts believe that the 1979 Islamic Revolution was able to turn Iran from a subservient state to a major power in the West Asia region and an influential player in global politics. Nigerian intellectual Dr. Imam Mukhtar says the Islamic Revolution became victorious because the people of Iran have had enough of imperialism.
the intervention, if you like to call it that, of Ayatollah Khomeini into that boiling point within the Iranian society at that particular point in time was very apt, and it has sent a strong signal to other parts of the world that you can also liberate yourself. Today, what you find is that Iran is not just trying to grow as an emerging power, but is in the rank of contending world powers.
The Islamic Revolution is steadfast in opposing imperialism and neocolonialism. Many nations in Africa are also suffering from neocolonialism and can therefore draw inspiration from Iran's resistance to bullying powers.
The only true anti-imperialist, anti-colonial movement is the Islamic Republic of Iran. And therefore, that is a source of inspiration, that this is a principled movement. This is a movement that stands against colonialism and occupation and imperialism. And in true respects, there's only one country that stands up in the world, and that is the Islamic Republic of Iran, backed by the theory of the Islamic Revolution. If we look at other nations within the region of the Middle East, or we would look at the GCC countries, all of them have actually colluded and aligned themselves with the imperialists and colonialists.
The Islamic Revolution of Iran deeply impacted on the uprising in South Africa against the U.S. and Israeli-backed apartheid regime. Following the victory of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini cut ties with the apartheid government of South Africa and offered assistance to freedom seekers in Africa. Many Southern Africa freedom fighters came to Iran, and eventually they were able to topple the apartheid regime in South Africa. It is on this strong basis that a very good relationship between the Islamic Republic of Iran and a free South Africa was born.
In 1996, the then Iranian President Ali Akbar Hashemi Rafsanjani visited South Africa and was warmly received by the then President Nelson Mandela. In a news conference following their meeting, Mandela defended his country's strong ties with the Islamic Republic of Iran and categorically stated that South Africa will not accept being told which countries could be its friends.
But we form our friendships on the basis of principle. And those who are with us when we're all alone will continue to be our friend. And the fact that any particular country may be their enemy does not influence our attitude. We are a sovereign and independent country, and we're prepared to defend that sovereignty and independence. And no country can dictate to us.
Well, what impact did the victory of the Islamic Revolution have on the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa?
The Islamic Revolution of 1979 had a massive impact on the anti-apartheid struggle here in South Africa, and I'll just draw one example. The Qibla movement, which was also an armed movement and a political thought movement founded by Imam Ahmed Qasim in Cape Town, was formed in 1981. They had relied very heavily on the concept of al-Mustadafin. And al-Mustadafin is a key concept within the Islamic Revolution. And this is where you draw from the rights of the dispossessed to re-establish their rights as equals and to restore their rights as people and human beings and their dignity. Therefore, one cannot discredit the massive impact that the Islamic Revolution had on the anti-apartheid struggle here in South Africa. In fact, many of the Qibla members and operatives went on to become key individuals in running many social organizations later during the liberation period here in South Africa post-1994, as well as holding key positions within government and other institutions and corporate institutions.
Now, South Africa has continued to enjoy close ties with Iran despite being under pressure from Western powers to reduce the level of engagement with Tehran. So what's the importance of these ties?
The South Africa moves closer to Iran because it can see Iran as what is happening to him is similar to what is happening to Iran. And from there, you can see they are sharing technology, they are sharing advancement, they are sharing a lot of things. And that's why you see the Western, the imperialists, they are threatening South Africa. Leave Iran. Don't do anything don't do any business with her, but you see, South Africa still insists they are having very good relationship with Iran, because Iran supported them during the apartheid time. Iran served as a model for them that if Iran can be able to defeat their own imperialists, the Shah, and some other people that are around them, so we can also do the same thing in South Africa. So the relationship is very good, and Iran is always welcome in South Africa.
Namibia and Zimbabwe were also inspired by Iran's Islamic Revolution during the struggle for independence. Iran supported the Southwest Africa People's Organization, a political party in Namibia, and the former independence movement in the country. Iran allowed SWAPO's diplomatic representation in Tehran and offered military, educational, and diplomatic support to SWAPO.
Zimbabwe and Iran also enjoy cordial relations dating back to the liberation struggle, which saw Harare attaining its independence in 1980. Now, how was Zimbabwe inspired by Iran's Islamic Revolution in its struggle for independence and continued resistance against Western powers that have imposed sanctions on this country?
The President Mugabe of Zimbabwe, he tried to have a very close relationship with Iran. And with that, he was able to develop his country to some level. And despite the fact there is a great of, they are giving him sanctions, different sanctions, because he's not working with the West in Zimbabwe. Because before the coming of Mugabe, you can say maybe roughly 90% of the land, 90% of the land of Zimbabwe is in the hand of the White. So when President Mugabe came into power, he drew all of them out, that the land belonged to us, not you. So he handed over the land down to the people, the citizens, the real citizens, that they will be using it for their family and some other things that they are doing. So they learned a lot of things with the Islamic Revolution of Iran, and they have a very good relationship with Iran, and there is a lot of transfer of technology, transfer of various experience that Iran has had to the Zimbabwe.
Well, I would like to thank Dr. Salati Bello for his insight on how the Islamic Revolution in Iran continues to inspire African nations. We shall take a short break before we continue our discussion with Mr. Zakir Ahmad in Johannesburg. Stay with us.
Iran's Islamic Revolution, an inspiration for Africa.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
Several African countries have faced U.S. sanctions due to various reasons. Now, currently, Zimbabwe is under severe EU and U.S. sanctions. Speaking during a previous session of the UN General Assembly, Zimbabwean President Emmerson Mnangagwa said his country has been able to achieve milestones in development despite the illegal sanctions.
These achievements are in spite of the continued albatross of the illegal economic sanctions. These sanctions constitute a denial of the human rights of the people of Zimbabwe to develop and improvement of their quality of life. Furthermore, the sanctions are slowing down our progress, inhibiting our economic recovery, and punishing the poorest and most vulnerable in our society.
Now, what experience can Zimbabwe draw from Iran, which continues to resist sanctions and has in fact attained self-sufficiency in various sectors?
If we look at the response of the Islamic Republic to global sanctions, it has been something that defies logic and astonishes most analysts. The Islamic Republic has resisted the attempts to economically cripple them, have developed indigenous arms systems, indigenous weapon systems. They have produced enough to sustain their own population in terms of food and other resources, and they have managed to make their economy a self-sustaining economy. This is the example that the countries that you have just mentioned, Zimbabwe, one of them, should actually follow. It requires, though, as a prerequisite, a discipline. It requires a principle, and it requires a leadership that is truly concerned about their population and not governed by the principles of self-interest and greed. That is what separates Iran from every other country. It's not just the mechanism of countering sanctions and developing their own indigenous capabilities to sustain their populations, but it's also a principled leadership.
The trade ties between Iran and Africa have seen tremendous progress over the last year. Iran exported 2.29 million tons of non-oil products valued over $1 billion to the African countries during the period from March 2022 up to December 2022.
Speaking before his visit to Africa last year, Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian stated that the Iranian government prioritizes strengthening relations with African countries. Well, the export of Iranian products to Africa has increased rapidly over the last 2 years. Now, what are the major factors behind these increase?
The major factor, I believe, is the recognition that the BRICS alliance is particularly important within the global domain. We have seen a systematic failure of the Western world to sustain a stable global economy. We see exactly that taking place with the issue of Russia and Ukraine, whereas global food supplies and global reliance on food and grains have been disrupted tremendously for political gains as opposed to any other gain. And this is seen from the prism of the global South as reckless and particularly dangerous. Therefore, we had to look at principled partners. We have to look at individuals that had the global economy and global stability at heart. And this is why we see the Islamic Republic as a self-sustaining economy, as one that has rejected sanctions and has sustained sanctions, has been able to prosper under these very difficult conditions as a perfect model and partner. This coupled with the fact that it is part of the BRICS nations. That is why when you look at the Iran-Africa Merchants Club, you see a massive increase in trade, up 39% in the last 8 months of 2022. So we see these individuals, or rather countries, as burning stars for us to migrate towards to ensure the stability of our own economies as well as stability of the African continent.
African countries such as Zimbabwe and DRC are working towards value addition of their raw materials to improve their economies and stop the plunder of their country's natural resources by Western countries. Iran has been able to develop its manufacturing industry despite crippling sanctions. Africa and Iran collaborating can establish close cooperation in effective utilization of these natural resources.
Iran has opened 8 trade centers in Africa aiming to develop trade ties with Africa. Now, the trade centers are located in Kenya, Uganda, Tanzania, Ivory Coast, Ghana, Cameroon, Senegal, Nigeria, and South Africa. Now, what more steps are needed to be taken to further deepen trade ties between Iran and Africa?
With Iran and Africa, there's a very big need for infrastructure. If I take, for example, South Africa in itself, South Africa is in dire need of infrastructure and basic resources such as power generation. The Islamic Republic of Iran has succeeded in establishing their own basic infrastructure, providing systems and their own indigenous development capabilities. However, I think the first step is to provide the support to the African continent in terms of infrastructure and power generation, as well as clean drinking water. These are basic necessities that are required desperately by the African continent. There's a lot in Africa that can be offered. We have a very vast pool of resources, and this is a natural ally to the Iranian people in the sense that we have both a legacy of anti-colonialism, anti-imperialism, and we can draw from that. I think a partnership in relation to infrastructure would be most positive in developing the channels of economics even further and mutual trade.
Well, there you have it. Iran and Africa are natural allies, as they both have a legacy of anti-colonialism. Unfortunately, our time is up for today, and I would like to thank our guest, Zakir Ahmed, for his insight on how the Islamic revolution in Iran continues to inspire African nations. And that brings us to the end of this week's edition of Africa Today. Thanks a lot and goodbye for now.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The U.S. so-called law enforcement has killed at least 1,176 people, or about 100 people a month last year, making it the deadliest for police violence. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of RT wrote in this regard, law enforcement officers killed an average of 3 people per day, but faced more violence in the line of duty. Cops in the U.S. killed 1,176 people in 2022, making last year the deadliest on record, according to a nonprofit group that tracks police violence. However, officers faced more attempts on their own lives as crime in some cities soared to new heights. Mapping Police Violence, a project connected to the Black Lives Matter movement, found that police fatally shot, beat, tased, and restrained 31 more people last